Welcome, I'm Rose Aguilar, and this is Your Call. Before we get started with today's show, we want to share some breaking news that came down about 30 minutes ago. U.S. Supreme Court Justice Stephen Breyer is retiring after serving more than two decades on the nation's highest court. This is according to two sources who spoke with NPR. NPR reports that he is expected to retire after the court's term ends this summer. During the 2020 campaign, President Biden said he would name an African-American woman to the court. The 6-3 court currently has an extreme conservative supermajority. Five of the nine justices were appointed by presidents who did not win the popular vote. And we will do a show about this very soon. But today we are going to talk about some of the bills that passed the California legislature last year. There were a lot, 770. Many went into effect on January 1st. And of course, they cover a huge range of issues, vote by mail, composting, the hiring of police officers, protections for garment workers and warehouse workers, prescribed burns to deal with all of the wildfires, and so many more. Joining us to give us an overview is Alexi Kossef, state capitol reporter with the San Francisco Chronicle. He previously spent 5 years in the Capitol Bureau of the Sacramento Bee. Hi, Alexi. Thanks so much for joining us.
Hi there. Thanks for having me on. I just want to mention that recently I've actually moved over to the news outlet CalMatters.
Oh, you're at CalMatters, one of our favorites. Well, congratulations. That's great. Well,
yeah, thank you so much.
Yeah, thank you so much for joining us. So, Alexi, when you sat down to highlight some of these laws, there's so many and there's so many important ones. How did you decide what to focus on?
I know you can't even begin to be comprehensive when you're doing a story like this because people's eyes will just completely glaze over. There are thousands of bills introduced every single year. Hundreds of them end up making it to the governor's desk and signed into law. So you really just try and pare it down to things that really have a direct impact on people's lives, are going to be a big change for the state, perhaps a controversial change. And then sometimes you just want to throw in a couple of quirky, fun things that will, you know, grab people's attention because they wouldn't expect that you'd even have a law about that in the first place.
So Governor Newsom signed 770 laws. That seems like such a big number. Is that what we usually see? Or does it stand out?
It is a big number, but it's actually a smaller number of bills than in the average year. The legislature scaled back last year because of the pandemic, and they required lawmakers to introduce fewer bills than usual. So in some years, you can see almost 1,000 new laws taking effect.
All right. Well, you and your colleagues have done a great job. So I want to go over as many as we can because there are so many important ones. Let's first focus on housing. You report that SB 9 by Senate President Pro Tem Tony Atkins, a Democrat of San Diego, creates a streamlined process to split lots, add second units to the properties, and convert homes into duplexes. You report that experts say it could help add hundreds of thousands of homes across the state by allowing up to four units on some properties that had just one before. But some cities are already rushing to limit its impact on their community. So tell us what's happening there.
I think this is one of the most, you know, interesting and potentially significant bills that got passed last year because of the constant debate that's been happening all across the state over how to respond to a shortage of available and affordable housing for Californians. If you remember a couple years back, there was legislation that was introduced that was really trying to force cities to allow more apartment buildings around transit in wealthy neighborhoods. And it was extremely controversial. It did not make it through, and it kept getting sort of scaled down and reintroduced in different forms. And this is sort of the compromise version of it that ultimately passed. So it won't have as wide range of an effect as some of the previous types of housing bills that have been introduced the goal is to try and get more housing built in a way that will still align with the feel of neighborhoods as they already exist by just adding maybe one or two more units per property that decides to take advantage of the law. But it still has created a huge amount of tension with local governments, which want to be in charge of how they develop as a community. And so, as you mentioned, there have been a number of cities that have gone ahead and passed ordinances in the months before this law took effect, emergency ordinances, to really limit the effects of the law to the bare minimum and try and prevent people from taking advantage of it by putting additional requirements on the law at the local level. So this is, you know, this is one that I think we'll continue to see play out in the years ahead, potentially through lawsuits and also, you know, through whether or not people really take advantage of the possibility and start adding more housing to their backyards.
You write that activists who support SB 9 say that they know of more than a dozen other cities across California, from Sonoma to Redondo Beach, in various stages of development or similar plans. They argue that communities are rushing to undermine the law by creating obstacles to build housing.
Yeah, one of the you know, the first one to actually do it was in the Bay Area. It was Los Altos Hills. And it happened in November, and there's others that have been in the works as well. And, you know, it's especially in sort of wealthy suburbs that have been the most resistant to some of these new laws that would force them to build more housing. But that also, by consequence, in some cases, have the biggest lots that might have the most potential to be split and add more units. So there's sort of a tension there between maybe the way people want to live and what the goals of the legislation are.
Another big one, of course, is SB 10 by Senator Scott Wiener, a Democrat from San Francisco, that allows cities to rezone some parcels in urban areas, including those near public transit, for up to 10 units without going through extensive environmental reviews. You report that AIDS Healthcare Foundation, which advocates on housing, opposed the bill as it was moving through the legislative process because it did not include requirements for affordable or homeless units. So what is the final text say? Does it include requirements for affordable or homeless units?
It does not. I mean, this is another source of tension that you often see in housing policy at the Capitol, between people who say, let's get more housing built and providing more supply will hopefully bring down the cost, and those who want to require affordability within every single project. And when you have a project that's only 10 units, some people say that requiring that even a single one of those units be set aside as below market rate could make it so that the project won't pencil out and nobody will actually take advantage of the law. So there's now a lawsuit that AIDS Healthcare Foundation is pursuing against this law. And it really will be a centerpiece in a ballot initiative that we could potentially see in November, which is trying to pull back local control to cities, give them an ability to override state housing law and determine their policies for themselves. AIDS Healthcare Foundation has put some money into that effort. It's collecting signatures now, and we'll see in the months ahead whether it qualifies. And in that case, there could be a really big fight on the ballot in the fall over, you know, whether these new housing laws the state has passed will stand or essentially get overturned.
This is such an important one. We'll definitely do a show. So those are a couple bills on housing. Let's talk about a few climate-related bills. And I also just want to mention that these aren't groundbreaking laws at all. We've had a couple reporters on from Capitol in Maine who have done stories about how really good climate legislation, if you talk to people in the environmental movement, has been killed in Sacramento because of big oil. And you have a couple Democrats who have the power to kill these laws. No Republican would vote for them, but you do have some Democrats who would kill some of these larger climate laws. So let's talk about the ones that did pass. SB 332 by Senator Bill Dodd, Democrat of Napa, would enable more private controlled fires by reducing the legal liability for burn bosses when a fire escapes control lines and requires an emergency response. This is really interesting, Alexi. Your colleague Julie Johnson wrote about the Good Fire Alliance. This is a group of Sonoma and Marin landowners, and they help property owners and land managers conduct controlled fires and other vegetation management projects. So how would this bill affect these efforts?
So you're absolutely right that, environmental policy is one of the areas in Sacramento, certainly where advocates seem to have hit a wall in recent years. It's not that Sacramento hasn't passed groundbreaking environmental legislation in the past that has really, you know, changed the course of the state. Certainly all kinds of laws have passed in the past two decades to address things like emissions and, the types of energy that we use. But definitely when it comes to oil use, that seems to be a place where advocates are not making a lot of progress in Sacramento.
Right.
Some of the areas where lawmakers really are trying to focus is on wildfires and, not just because it puts so many people's lives at risk every year, but also because, these huge wildfires that we've had in recent years are contributing a large amount of, carbon emissions to the atmosphere as well. So by trying to encourage more private prescribed burns, as this law does, they're hoping that they can bring more people into the effort to, get vegetation management under control and protect communities by taking away some of the worst, most flammable fuels around neighborhoods and homes before a fire sparks up and puts them at risk.
And again, we should do a show about this because your colleague Julie Johnson reports that there are so many groups now, a growing number of groups across the state, to help property owners burn vegetation in fire-prone areas, and they work in concert with local fire agencies like CAL FIRE. We've done shows about indigenous people, obviously mm-hmm. doing this for many, many years. A couple other climate-related bills, AB 1276 would prohibit dine-in restaurants, drive-thrus from handing out single-use utensils and condiment packets unless the customer asks. SB 138, we're going to do a show about this because this is huge. It's going to require Californians to toss food scraps, paper mm-hmm. towels, yard waste in those green bins rather than the trash. This is the largest mandatory composting effort in the country. We should say that penalties will not go into effect until 2024. So until then, there's a lot of educating to do.
Yeah, I mean, this is actually a really fascinating law. And it's one of those ones that could, if it's done right, I mean, it could fundamentally change the state, but there's a lot of heavy lifting that has to happen to really make it work. So right now, not every city actually has, even though the law's taken effect, not every city was ready for that. And so, the state is still working with cities to make sure that they're providing homeowners with the green waste bins to throw out their, their food scraps and things so that those can be composted, to make sure they have the kind of equipment that they need to process those food scraps into composting and all of that. And over the next couple of years, there will be more sort of enforcement mechanisms and things taking effect. And the goal is that by 2030, half of all food waste that would otherwise go to landfills be diverted.
Right. We'll definitely do a show about this because it can be confusing. Counties accept different items, for example. We just got a question from a listener who says the city of Santa Clara just contracted in December to have food scraps placed in our regular garbage with the waste hauler to then separate. That sounds like a really difficult job. Reportedly, the separated food waste cannot be composted for use with human food. Is this compliant with the new law or grandfathered as a pre-existing contract to avoid the law until the contract is up for renewal? Any idea, Alexi?
I wish I had a better answer. I can't say that I'm super familiar with what's going on in any particular city. I do know, though, that I think there is some latitude for different local governments to, you know, try and come up with a system that works for them. I mean, it's a complex law because there's not just requirements on cities and homeowners. There's also going to be requirements on supermarkets and hotels and other kinds of businesses that have large amounts of food waste on the consumer level to then try and donate some of that rather than throwing it out to people in need, so that to reduce food waste that way too. So it's a complex law that has a lot of moving pieces that are still rolling out. And I just don't have a great answer at this point about what any one particular city has set up or not.
Thank you for the comment, Tahir. We will definitely do a show about this. And again, non-compliance can result in fines, but the penalties will not go into effect until 2024. One more on the environment, SB 343. Products can no longer carry the chasing arrow recycling symbol when they are not really recyclable. The Surfrider Foundation, which supported this bill, says manufacturers use the chasing arrow symbol, even if their products are not recyclable, to get consumers to purchase their goods. So how would this bill change that?
So this is another one that's going to take a couple of years to go into effect, because the ultimate effect is actually going to be changing what you can recycle or not in California. In that chasing arrow symbol that a lot of people are familiar with, you might see different numbers between 1 and 7. And maybe you've never really thought much before about what those mean, but they actually reflect different types of plastic. And most places only really are capable of recycling a 1 or maybe even a 2. And so, we think then that these other kinds of things that have that symbol are recyclable, but they end up getting thrown into the trash just because the places where we live don't have any ability to deal with them. So over time, the state is going to be changing the standards, and it's ultimately going to kind of narrow down the recycling program to really focus on those products that typically have a 1 or a 2 on them, that type of plastic that is really more universally recyclable, and make sure that all of that stuff is getting recycled.
Today, we are speaking with Alexi Kossef, a reporter with Cal Matters, about some of the laws that passed in the California legislature last year, a total of 770, so many important laws. If there's one that you'd like to share, one that stood out for you, one that you followed, we'd love to hear from you. 866-798-8255, 866-798-8255. You can also email yourcall@kalw.org. Let's talk about some of the laws that affect labor. Over the past few years, we've done so many shows about California's 45,000 garment workers. They're overwhelmingly immigrant women. And because they were paid per piece, they made as little as $3 an hour. And after many, many years of organizing and going to Sacramento, the Garment Worker Protection Act passed. It was signed into law in September, and it finally guarantees a minimum wage for these workers, and it holds brands liable for stolen wages. I have to say, Alexi, every time we did this show, these women and men work in Southern California. And we always asked, how is something like this even legal in the state of California? Then again, you can talk about farm workers. Same thing applies to them. But this was a groundbreaking law, and it finally passed.
Yeah, you know, being in Sacramento, it's very interesting to watch over the last few years how there have been some real profound shifts that have happened around minimum wage and labor protections around just sort of a few remaining industries that, because of various sorts of exceptions in labor law have been allowed to exist in this way. Obviously, this one for garment workers was a big one this year. A couple of years ago, after many years of effort, they passed a law to give overtime to farm workers, which had been never been the case before, and that's starting to roll out into effect now as well. So, because of various sort of historical precedents, essentially, that have been set at the federal level, at the state level, and at the industry level, there are a lot of these kinds of workers who were left behind from what we think of as being the standard operating procedure for workers in California.
And then another big one, the fact that we need a law like this in California, AB 701, prohibits companies like Amazon from punishing workers who take bathroom breaks or mandatory rest periods. It also creates legal paths for employees to challenge working conditions. And Alexi, again, your former colleague at the San Francisco Chronicle, Carolyn Said, had really an incredible piece. She profiled Yesenia Barrera, who had a quota of processing 100 items an hour when she worked at an Amazon center in San Bernardino County. And, she said that they didn't go to the bathroom because it was a 5-minute walk away. And Ellen Reese, chair of a labor studies program at UC Riverside, interviewed 82 workers who said many say they feel they don't have time to use the restroom. Okay, so now we have a law prohibiting companies like Amazon from punishing these workers. But how is this going to be enforced? Do you know?
Right. So, this is one of those sort of things where workers, it's supposed to give workers a little bit more empower them a little bit more to assert their rights. So, you have a situation where the effect is that it should allow them to go to the bathroom. But, in practice, the way it's written, it's one of those things where it's on the company not to punish people for missing a certain quota because they took time off to do something they're legally allowed to do, like have a rest break or go to the bathroom or take their lunch break or something like that. So, in reality, it will take, to be enforced, it might be a situation where if the company violates it, then a worker will have to report it to, a union or a, the labor department of the state to investigate. It's going to need to go to authorities to act on it. The hope is that by putting it into law, it will sort of, create a new standard that companies will at least try to then follow.
Yeah. And I guess the other question is, and we can talk about this on another show, but since these workers are not in a union and they do not have protections, how will they know if they're going to be receiving retaliation or being fired if they speak out? So this is such an important issue. So we'll definitely do a show about this. Alexi, we're almost out of time. If any others that you want to talk about just briefly? Election officials are going to mail every registered voter a ballot for all future elections. Vote by mail in California. We really wish we had this across the country. Any others that really stand out for you that we should know about?
Sure. I mean, I think the one, this vote by mail law is a huge one because it was an experiment during the pandemic. And, it was a successful one. And so now the state is adopting it completely. So, that has a profound effect for people. There's some fun things that lawmakers do occasionally, too. I think one, that may be worth noting is that for at least the next couple years, the state will continue to allow restaurants to sell, takeout mixed drinks and glasses of wine with your, with your order. That was a sort of a creation of the pandemic as well that was never allowed, but it proved popular. It was very helpful for restaurants to continue to survive. And now it, who knows, may become a permanent thing in the state. So, from the very profound about housing to the very, mundane about cocktails to go, there's a law for almost everything in California.
Well, thank you for your great reporting, Alexi. Thanks so much for joining us and congrats on your new job at CalMatters.
Thanks so much. Appreciate it.
Alexei Kossoff is a reporter with CalMatters, and you can find some of the pieces he wrote about the new laws taking effect in California. 770 passed last year. Many went into effect on January 1st. Find more information at yourcallradio.org. Coming up after a break, we will talk about the new laws affecting police and criminal justice. This is Your Call. We'll be back after this. This is Your Call. I'm Rose Aguilar. Now we are going to talk about some new laws on policing and criminal justice in California. One law ends mandatory minimum sentencing for nonviolent drug crimes. Others affect military equipment and firing rubber bullets or tear gas at a protest. Laura Bazelon is a professor of law and the director of the Criminal, Juvenile Justice, and Racial Justice Clinical Programs at the University of San Francisco School of Law. From 2012 to 2015, she was a visiting associate clinical professor at Loyola Law School and director of the Loyola Law School Project for the Innocent. Laura Bazelon is the author of Rectify, The Power of Restorative Justice After Wrongful Conviction, and A Good Mother, which is a novel of suspense. Hi, Laura. Thanks so much for joining us again.
Thank you for having me.
Well, it's great to have you. Let's first talk about this mandatory minimum sentence law, SB 73, introduced by Senator Scott Wiener from San Francisco, ends mandatory minimum sentences for nonviolent drug crimes, giving judges discretion to hand down probation instead of jail time for things like possession of a small amount of heroin. So tell us more about this law.
Sure. So this is a bill that was carried by State Senator Scott Wiener, and it was designed to push back against some of what the majority of the legislature considers the excesses of the war on drugs. So in the 1980s, California, among many states, passed measures basically taking away discretion from judges to sentence people to probation instead of jail time for certain drug crimes. And also in cases in which it was a second offense, for example, a simple possession second offense, also making jail time mandatory. So this bill rolls that back and gives judges discretion to sentence those kinds of offenders to probation instead of jail.
It sounds like this is actually a really big deal, because in the Chronicle, San Francisco public defender Mano Raju said too many people quickly take a deal with prosecutors and plead guilty to avoid lengthy jail or prison time. And he said the bill would let judges hand down more appropriate sentences.
I think that is exactly right, in the sense that many, many people who are in jail, cannot make bail, and are offered deals, take them because they are very, very concerned about getting longer sentences. And this gives the lawyers who represent them, overwhelmingly public defenders, much more leverage, especially with judges who are more sympathetic to arguments that people who commit these kinds of crimes generally need treatment and rehabilitation rather than jail and prison time.
Right. How does this fit into the broader push to reshape California's approach to drug policy and what we've seen over the past few decades?
I think it's part of this movement to recognize that people who commit drug offenses oftentimes suffer from addiction. And it's part of a movement to see addiction as a disease rather than a pathology. And also a recognition that when you lock people up rather than offer them treatment, you often are just essentially making sure that there's a revolving door where people are going to get back out and continue to commit crimes rather than address the root causes of why people are committing these crimes in the first place.
In the article in the Chronicle, George Gascon, the new LA district attorney, who was the former San Francisco district attorney, said that his office is going to look at as many as 30,000 old cases to determine whether to seek shorter sentences or release longtime prisoners. Laura, do you know how many people are right now sitting in jail because of these drug offenses?
Tens of thousands, if not more. And I think this gets to another issue, which is the cost of incarcerating people. So right now in the state of California, it costs about $81,000 a year to incarcerate a single individual, which, if you think about it, is more costly than an extremely pricey private university tuition. And so I think there's a recognition that, number one, there's not a public safety issue with releasing people who are not committing serious or violent crimes. And number two, that in terms of money, fiscal responsibility, it may make more sense to look into alternatives that are much less expensive and also more likely to be effective, such as treatment.
Exactly. And according to so many studies, it's overwhelmingly people of color, overwhelmingly poor people. And thanks to advocates, we are all now learning just how violent the system is. So you're throwing someone in jail for a drug offense. It affects them, obviously. It affects their kids if they have kids. So many people in jail have kids. It affects the family and it affects the entire community.
That's right. And you get at a really important point, which is that statistics show that people who are white and people who are Black and Latinx, they all use and sell drugs at similar rates. And yet when you look at who is actually being detained, arrested, and prosecuted, it is overwhelmingly people of color. And there's no other way to explain it other than there's implicit and systemic bias in the way that these laws are enforced. And so what happens is the police aren't, for example, patrolling college campuses or private high schools looking for people who are dealing or using drugs, right? They're going into neighborhoods that are considered high crime, so-called inner city neighborhoods, and that's where the prosecution and arrests are being targeted. And so what you're seeing is disparate impact and disproportionate enforcement.
Let's talk about one that's related. SB 81 from Senator Nancy Skinner, a Democrat from Berkeley, directs judges considering sentencing enhancements to give greater weight to mitigating factors like whether the offense was connected to mental illness or child trauma, or whether the enhancement is based on a prior conviction that is more than 5 years old. First off, can you tell us what are these sentencing enhancements?
Sure. They go by a variety of names. They're called nickel priors. They can be gun or gang enhancements. But essentially what it does is it tacks on consecutive time. So let's say you get 3 or 4 years, you could end up getting 10 years consecutive on some kind of multiple sentencing enhancement. And so these enhancements drive sentences up, basically ballooning them out of all proportion. And what this bill is trying to do is tell judges, look, you've always had the discretion to dismiss enhancements, and yet you rarely do. But here are reasons why you should, and you need to give great weight to these mitigating circumstances. Basically saying to judges, you need to use your discretion much more than you have been. And so if the underlying conviction is not a violent felony, if by applying the enhancement, you're going to perpetuate a racial disparity, and here we get into gun and gang enhancements in particular, if, as you say, the conviction relates to some kind of mental illness or victimization, or if it's an old case, then you really need to not enhance. And so it's just a way of giving muscle and rigor to a power that exists that is rarely deployed by the judiciary.
Is this going to be a requirement, or do you just have to hope that you're going to get an open-minded, somewhat compassionate judge?
It is not going to be a requirement. And to be clear, if none of those factors apply, and also if the judge determines that there would be a risk to public safety by not imposing an enhancement, the judge can still impose an enhancement. So it isn't mandatory, but it makes it harder to impose them and it makes it easier to appeal them.
A couple others that are related, AB 1540 from Assemblymember Phil Ting, strengthens the second look sentencing process. This bill would require the court to state its reasons for resentencing, a resentencing decision on the record. The bill would require the court to provide notice to the defendant, set a status conference within 30 days of the receipt of the request, and appoint counsel for the defendant. Tell us more about this one.
This one's really important. So basically, it's building upon an existing law that's called Section 1170D, and that law empowered local district attorneys to seek to recall and reduce sentences. So basically, if a local DA and obviously the petitioner's counsel agree, this person who's doing, say, 60, 70, 90, 125 years is fully rehabilitated and no longer posing a risk to public safety, we want this person to get out, they could move to recall that sentence and have them even sentenced to time served. But the application of the law ran into some obstacles. Judges were very, very hesitant to resentence people who had been convicted of, say, murder, attempted murder, various serious crimes, and sentenced to these indeterminate sentences. And what the law changes make clear to the judge is, look, you can not only resentence people convicted of something like murder, you can resentence them to any lesser included offense. And if the parties agree, there's a strong presumption in favor of you resentencing this person. And so if you're not inclined to go along with the parties, judge, then what you need to do are put your reasons on the record. And essentially, again, this is putting muscle behind this law and saying to judges, you have this discretion. When there's agreement by the parties, you really ought to be resentencing. And if you're not, then you need to have a very good reason why.
And one more on sentencing. SB 483 from Senator Bill Allen retroactively repeals two enhancements and allows 10,000 people to have new sentencing hearings.
Yes. So this is also very important, again, because of its far-reaching effects. So like 1170 and the recent amendment that you and I just discussed, this one has broad application. As you say, 10,000 people could get a new sentencing hearing if at their first sentencing hearing, they got enhancements that were based on, for example, drug laws or certain kinds of violent felonies. And these sentencing enhancements are basically no longer considered to be legally valid, meaning that there's no way to kind of present an obstacle to someone like that seeking to be resentenced because the mechanism that was used to enhance their sentence is no longer valid.
You have been working with incarcerated people for so many years, working on these issues. During the pandemic, we saw jail and prison populations go down, and now they're going back up again. And women, the number of women in prison is rising more than the number of men. Can you just tell us, Laura, I mean, to think of these laws are really, really important, but the fact that people have to go through this system to try to bring down nonviolent drug crime sentences and have to wait for these laws to be passed, what else needs to be done to really tackle this crisis?
That's a great question. And I think one of the things that we need to do is not only expand avenues of relief toward people who are convicted of non-serious, non-violent offenses who are serving time in jails and prisons, but also expand those avenues of relief to people who are convicted of so-called serious crimes. You know, you mentioned women and the astronomical increase in female prisoners. So often what's going on with these women is what experts call criminalized survival, meaning that they were in abusive relationships and took some kind of action to defend themselves. Perhaps it was imperfect self-defense, but basically these are people who are in highly abusive and traumatic situations, and they're getting these extremely long terms when the fact of the matter is they don't pose a public safety danger. It's that they were in a very specific abusive relationship. And it's people like that who also need avenues to relief. You mentioned earlier people being separated from their children and their families. I mean, there is nothing more traumatic for children than to be deprived of having a primary parent in the home, which is most often the mother. And so we really need to start thinking about how to re-knit communities rather than ripping them apart. And we need to think about, okay, who are we protecting here? And who are we really depriving of an opportunity to have a good, fulfilling, and productive life on the outside?
How would you assess the Democratic Party in California and how they are doing on these issues? Because we have a supermajority of Democrats in Sacramento. In our last segment, we talked about how, while yes, some good climate change legislation has passed, a lot of the oil-related bills are killed by big oil. It just takes a handful of Democrats to kill it. So how would you assess or rate Democrats on these issues in California?
As a progressive Democrat, I find the bills coming out of the California legislature to be so heartening. When I look at how dysfunctional the federal government is, and particularly Congress, and then I look at what these supermajorities are able to accomplish, the creativity, the breadth of the reforms, the constant moving towards more innovative thinking, building upon prior legislation, it's very, very impressive. And it's really even more impressive when you compare it to systems elsewhere that seem rather regressive or dysfunctional.
Laura Bazelon is a professor of law and director of the Criminal Juvenile Justice and Racial Justice Clinical Programs at the University of San Francisco School of Law. She's the author of Rectify, The Power of Restorative Justice After Wrongful Conviction. And we're talking about some of the laws that have passed in California affecting criminal justice and policing. Before we get to policing, are there any other criminal justice laws we should know about?
Yes, there's one other that I wanted to make sure that I mentioned. So last year, the legislature passed something called the California Racial Justice Act, which is very wide-ranging in its scope for relief. Essentially, it prevents the state from getting a criminal conviction or imposing a sentence based on race. And it makes it possible for a person who's either been charged or convicted of a crime to challenge their case based on racial bias. The thing is, it's prospective only, meaning that it starts from the date that it went into effect. And so for people whose convictions are final, they can't access the Racial Justice Act to try to get relief from their convictions. And so what's moving through the legislature right now is building upon that legislation. It's called AB 256. And what it would do was it would make the Racial Justice Act retroactive. So it needs to get voted out of the Senate Appropriations Committee, and then it needs to get on the floor, needs to get passed by both the Senate and the Assembly and signed by the governor. And I think advocates are cautiously optimistic that that could happen. Were that to happen, people who have done decades with no hope of relief because they simply didn't have a viable path back into court would suddenly have that opportunity.
Well, let's talk about some of the policing laws. Let's first focus on police. AB 958 by Assemblymember Mike Gibson, Democrat of Carson in LA County. Police can be fired for participating in a law enforcement gang, a group of officers within a department that engages in a pattern of rogue on-duty behavior. How significant is this one?
I think it's important. I mean, if some of your listeners will remember back to the Rampart scandal in Los Angeles, what you had was this anti-gang unit within the Los Angeles Police Department that basically became a gang itself and committed all kinds of crimes and even framed innocent people. And it's this idea that in prosecuting crime, you can't sort of adopt the elements of the people that you're going after and become a perpetrator yourself. And while it might seem far-fetched to think that that would ever happen, in fact, the history in California shows that it can and it does.
Let's talk about AB 26 by Assemblymember Chris Holden, a Democrat of Pasadena. It requires law enforcement agencies to adopt policies that mandate immediate reporting when an officer witnesses a colleague using excess force and punishes those who do not intervene. This one is really interesting, Laura, because we've talked about a recent USA Today really in-depth investigation that found police departments across the country crack down really hard on whistleblowers. So how significant is AB 26?
It's very significant in the sense that it's trying to get at this blue wall of silence, which is this ingrained practice in the police department of turning a blind eye toward misconduct by colleagues. And as you say, for the officers that do stick their necks out and actually report what they see when it's wrong, the punishment that accrues to them. So this is kind of taking that and flipping it and saying, look, not only can you not retaliate against whistleblowers, but if you don't blow the whistle, you yourself could be in trouble.
Here's another important one, AB 490. Police can no longer use restraints and transport methods that carry a substantial risk of suffocating the suspect.
Right. Okay. So this is clearly a response to the killings that we've seen across the country and have gotten all kinds of media attention. And it's very, very important, right? Because what we're seeing all too often, and all too often it's men of color getting arrested for, say, selling loose cigarettes in the case of Eric Garner, passing a counterfeit $20 bill in the case of George Floyd, and not living through the experience of that arrest, and in many cases being asphyxiated. And so there's this real movement toward trying to make these practices, and by practices, I mean the practice of arresting somebody, much more safe, such that getting arrested on the street isn't a death sentence, as it has been shown to be.
Well, exactly. And this reminds us of what happened to Freddie Gray, April 12th, 2015, arrested by Baltimore police over possessing a knife while being transported in a police van. He sustained injuries, taken to a trauma center, tragically died on April 19th. His death was ascribed to injuries to his spinal cord. You know, the question, I mean, this is just devastating, but how will these be enforced? I guess when you think about it, AB 490 could be kind of connected to AB 26. So if someone is in transit and is clearly having issues, someone else needs to speak up.
Yes. And I think one thing that these reforms are going to turn on is the willingness of prosecutors to use these laws. Because all too often, I think there's pressure not to prosecute the police, not to take a firm hand when there is misconduct, because there's such a close association between the police and prosecutors. And because many people running for local district attorney or even statewide office, they need the support of the police officers' associations. And so for these laws to really have any effect or bite to them, teeth, they need to actually be used. And I think that that's what's going to be really interesting to see, is whether DAs across the state of California are going to use these tools to try to combat misconduct.
AB 48 by Assemblymember Lorena Gonzalez, Democrat of San Diego, prohibits police from firing rubber bullets or tear gas at a protest unless it's a life-threatening situation. How will that one play out?
I think, again, this is a response to some of the protests that we saw, particularly in the wake of the killing of George Floyd, where you had largely peaceful, not entirely peaceful, but largely peaceful protests. And in some localities, they were met with rubber bullets, with force that just really wasn't necessary. And I think this legislation is designed to say, look, police, when there's a largely peaceful protest and there's no imminent danger to you, using rubber bullets, injuring civilians, it's not appropriate, and you can't do that. It's not legal anymore.
Yeah, and this one reminds me, I was thinking about the veteran who was hit with a rubber bullet. It was Scott Olson at an Occupy protest in Oakland back in, 2011. Wow, that's been 10 years since Occupy. And he went to the hospital, and he said, photos and videos suggest that police used rubber bullets and flashbangs, and the Oakland Police Department said that they did not. So it'll be interesting how this one plays out. And then here's another really important one by AB 481 by Assemblymember David Chu of San Francisco. Requires law enforcement. Actually, he's no longer an Assemblymember. San Franciscans have to choose a new one soon. Requires law enforcement agencies to seek approval from their local governing bodies when they buy surplus military equipment.
Yes. So there's the rise of what we know as the militarization of the police force, where they get huge amounts of excess military gear that is basically turning them almost into like an internal armed force in a way that may not be necessary. And so I think this is trying to put a check on, or at least some oversight on, how this equipment is getting dispersed and whether or not it is in fact necessary.
What is the latest with this? Do you have any idea? Because this issue got a lot of attention a couple of years ago.
It did. And actually, there's a wonderful book by the journalist Radley Balco on this very issue, The Rise of the Warrior Cop, and how that is playing out in the streets. And I feel like it's an ongoing issue enough such that there is still legislation trying to deal with it, because what we see is the deployment of some of this gear in a way that's actually endangering public safety rather than keeping the public safe.
You know, because so many people are focused on what's going on in DC, I'm sure a lot of people are just not familiar with so many of these important laws. Of course, it's so hard to keep up with all of it, but anything else you'd like to bring to our attention in our remaining minutes, Laura?
Yes, I think there's a package of reforms that were introduced by Senator Nancy Skinner that I think bear mentioning. So, you know, she was the force behind a landmark law in 2018, SB 1421. California has some of the most secretive laws around the airing or keeping secret of police personnel files. And so her initial bill allowed for transparency around certain kinds of misconduct by police, specifically sexual assault and dishonesty, that the public was allowed to have those records. Her new bill, which was signed by Gavin Newsom, SB 16, expands those categories so that there's now open access to sustained findings on officers that use unreasonable force and officers who engage in racist or biased behavior or conduct unlawful arrests and searches. And then there's also SB 2, which ensures that officers who are rogue, disciplined officers can't just jump from one police agency to the next. It allows for them to be stripped of their badges for professional misconduct. I will note that that law does not take effect until 2023. There is a one-year grace period.
Well, Laura, thank you so much for joining us to go over these important laws, and thanks for all of your important work.
Thank you so much for having me. It was a pleasure to talk to you.
Laura Bazelon is professor of law and director of the Criminal Juvenile Justice and Racial Justice Clinical Program at the University of San Francisco School of Law. She's the author of Rectify, The Power of Restorative Justice After Wrongful Conviction, and A Good Mother, which is a novel of suspense. And you can find more information about all of the laws that have passed. Again, so many, 770. A couple that we haven't gotten to, businesses with 26 or more employees will be required to pay a $15 minimum wage starting in 2022. In some cities in California, it's actually higher than that. SB 221 requires that mental health and substance abuse patients be offered return appointments no more than 10 days after a previous session, unless their provider okays less frequent visits. We know that under COVID, it was so hard to get an appointment. We're doing a long series on mental health in the coming weeks. So that one's really, really important. AB 1096 strikes the word alien from state law, replaces it with person who is not a citizen. And then California is streamlining its assisted death process, making it easier for people to obtain a lethal prescription and end their lives on their own terms. We know that one's controversial. We've done some shows about that. You can find more information at yourcallradio.org. I should say, very controversial among the disability rights community. Thanks to Chris Nooney for producing today's show. Thanks to Kevin Vance for engineering our show. Thanks so much for joining us. I'm Rose Aguilar. It's Your Call.